This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks.
I literally have to watch my bag because two of these kids that have made these threats on Facebook talk about that's why he's dead, live minutes, not miles, minutes from my house.
That was local mother Patricia Franklin talking in the aftermath of the shooting death of her son, Cameron, who was 14, and the troubles she sees in her neighborhood of Lower Price Hill. More than 30 people have been shot and killed in Cincinnati so far this year, including 5 teenagers. Now, Cincinnati police are stepping up patrols. And what do city leaders believe is behind this spike in violence? Let's discuss with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Cameron Knight. Welcome, Cameron.
Thank you.
And WVXU reporter Ambriel Crutchfield. Welcome back, Ambriel.
Hey, hey.
513-419-7100 is the number to call if you wish to ask questions or offer some comments during this conversation. You can email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and get some of those into the show. So that sound we heard at the top of this segment here is from Patty Franklin, whose 14-year-old son Cameron was shot and killed in Lower Price Hill last week. What were the circumstances that we know of so far in this boy's death?
My understanding is that we actually don't know a whole lot about what he was doing. There were some initial reports that he was coming home from a party just before midnight when he was shot. There was some conflicting information at the beginning about whether or not it was a stray bullet situation. But Patty Franklin, the mother that we heard from, believes now that her son was killed in retribution. She told me that there was a fight at his high school, West High, back earlier this year. And since then, her son's been pretty a little bit different, and that he's been a little bit scared about different things. And she's reached out for help. He was actually caught a charge as a result of the fight at West High. He was charged with assault. He had to go to juvenile court. He was sentenced to community service, which he completed very, very quickly. And so for whatever the circumstances of that fight were, he was punished for it. He did his time, so to speak. And now she's saying that she believes it's retribution kind of dating back to that incident. And, you know, she's piecing things together on Facebook and social media. You know, she said that she went through her son's social media messages after he passed. And just in the days leading up to it, he was receiving threats and saying that, you know, one of the messages that he allegedly received that she told me about was that he, you know, someone said, "Your mother's going to bury you." And so, yeah, it sounds like it's a pretty dire situation.
Have there been arrests in this particular case?
There have not.
Cincinnati Police Chief Elliot Isaac held a news conference following this string of deadly shootings in the city, but he didn't allow Franklin to attend that news conference, I understand. What did the chief say his plan is for addressing this spike first?
So, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, so they're actually trying to go at different ways, adding 42 new officers to these communities that are quote unquote higher risk, reducing support units are some of the effort, and lowering supervisor ranks so that there are more people on the ground and in these communities.
And he says that the department's going to focus on gangs and some of the hot spots in the city where they're seeing some of this violence take place. How does he plan to execute that?
So my understanding is that this is their ongoing tactic. They have long ago said that they've abandoned doing like large sweeps through neighborhoods. You know, 20 years ago, if this was all like if this kind of violence was happening in a neighborhood, they would have swept it like and just charged anybody who was doing anything wrong and try to sweep up as many people as they could. To try to stem the violence. They don't take that tact anymore because they don't feel like honestly, it stems from the collaborative agreement. They don't feel like that's appropriate. So they now in all times, even when there isn't a spike in violence, try to laser focus on the violent offenders who are actually causing harm. And that's their approach now. And a lot of that has to do with they call it violent offender territory. And they focus in on those areas where it's apparently easier to be a criminal. And they try to go to those areas and make it harder to be a criminal. That's basically kind of the tactic that they're using to try to really focus in on trigger pullers, as they like to call them, and to also try to also respect the rest of the community. It's obviously a hard balance.
And just to jump in on that, I did speak to some people that are doing community outreach in those communities to kind of prevent that from happening. And their main thing was, okay, we need to be hitting the ground a lot harder and making sure we're preventing this. And that looks like different things, of course, just connecting and letting them know that there are opportunities outside of their community and resources available to them, and really connecting the people with that so they don't feel like this is the last result.
We talked about social media and the role that it may have played in the death of 14-year-old Cameron Franklin. But there's another post on social media locally that is causing some controversy. Fraternal Order of Police President Dan Hills upset Patty Franklin, the victim's mother, certainly. He posted a locally made rap video that may have included that 14-year-old in the shots. And Hills said, quote, "This is in Price Hill. These are our young people. This is a crisis." We've got some sound from Patty Franklin's response to that video, and also some sound from Vice Mayor Chris Smitherman.
You're supposed to be investigating a crime. Why are you worried about posting a video? Whether he was in the right or wrong, it doesn't matter. Whether he was in the video or not in the video, why is it being posted? I'm not that parent that tries to say he was innocent if he's not.
I know that our outreach workers would be wonderful in responding and following back up to those young people. But the government can't solve every one of these issues. This is a collective effort on all of our parts to keep our community safe.
So we heard Mother Patricia Franklin talking about the video that was posted by FOP President Dan Hills. What other types of reaction to this video have we heard, if any?
So on the Facebook post, it was basically a shared video, a music video, and it did look like young people. There were young people holding guns, but like their ages are not confirmed. There was a guy that was white in the video, but again, we don't know who he is. He could be Cameron Franklin. He could be anybody. A lot of the comments were actually kind of disturbing on the Facebook post, saying that where are their parents? Back in my day, this would have never happened because people would have been there. And so I kind of heard a lot of that at the press conference, a lot of different public officials saying, we're trying to do our role here, but community and family, you need to step up. And so Patricia Franklin did push back on that and what that looks like. There are parents that work later nights. A lot of the community outreach people said that. And so they suggested, hey, there used to be churches and recreation centers that were open a little bit later that people could go to and be in a positive environment to hang out in and not be in the street. Why don't we open those back up? And so that is something that's kind of interesting to ponder.
And if this is a bigger problem than just criminality, what response from the community are we hearing? Are churches or community centers saying that they're going to step up and try to find a way to keep the youth out of trouble?
Yeah, I mean, I've spoken to several pastors, Pastor Ennis Tate and Pastor Peterson Mingo, who's one of these outreach workers we've spoken to, and they're definitely trying to respond, and not only to try to make space for teens, but also to try to respond directly to these families who are affected, because a big part of the goal with all of this outreach is to prevent retaliation shootings, which we've had at least one that seems very retaliatory, one homicide in Cincinnati that seems retaliatory since the beginning of the year. It's the back and forth that they're trying to stop, and I think that's where a lot of the churches are trying to step in.
We're seeing the spike in violence, but it's been reported that this isn't necessarily the highest volume of shootings that we've had at this point in any given year. Is it just that we're seeing so many of them in rapid succession? Is that what's causing the concern in the police department?
Yeah, so the total number of shootings that we've seen this year, when you look at it year to date compared to last year, we're about neck and neck. And last year was a very, very good year for Cincinnati in terms of the number of shootings. It was the lowest basically in, I think, like 7 or 8 years. The number of homicides, again, neck and neck, total number of homicides. However, I think when people reference a surge or a spike, they're particularly referring to June, which based on my research is the deadliest month Cincinnati has seen since at least the year 2000. So for at least 19 years, we have not had a month with more homicides than we did in June. And the only reason I am limiting it to the year 2000 is that's as far back as our digital kind of easily searchable records go. But I would reckon, just based on looking at homicide data over the past like several decades, it's probably much, much further than that. It was a very, very bad month for Cincinnati in terms of homicides.
And what about the data as it relates to teens being involved? So in addition to 14-year-old Cameron Franklin being gunned down in Lower Price Hill, we also had 14-year-old Anthony Hinton shot and killed in Over the Rhine. 15-year-old Jordan Lara was killed during an attempted robbery that she may have been allegedly committing. Was she killed in self-defense?
Jordan's a boy, and the police said that Jordan and another boy were robbing someone. The victim alleged, again, this is all according to police, this is all alleged, the victim fired in self-defense, killing Jordan, and actually his co-conspirator, so to speak, who was another 14-year-old boy, has been charged with murder in that case, which is another kind of separate issue of proximity to crimes and things like that. But in terms of overall juvenile violence, sadly, and now granted, we have had a lot of homicides recently, and they've all kind of been bunched together, which is troubling. But in terms of shooting and juveniles getting shot, this is sadly, we're on par for how we have been for the past 5 years. On average, over the past 5 years, about 3 juveniles a month get shot. And we're, if you look at this year, it's the exact same. I wrote a very long, in-depth story about juvenile gun violence and the victims last year, and it hasn't changed.
Cameron Knight from the Cincinnati Inquirer and Ambriel Crutchfield from here at WVXU. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Until you experience it, it's hard to comprehend the hidden costs of being poor. That was the headline of an editorial written by Inquirer editor Burl Love. That newspaper continues its year-long coverage of The Long, Hard Road, a deep look at poverty and its effects. And joining Cincinnati Edition to talk about the latest installments, our Inquirer editor, Burl Love. Welcome, Burl.
Thank you.
Inquirer race and community reporter, Mark Kernute. Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you.
And Inquirer photojournalist and producer, Albert Caesar. Welcome, Albert.
Thank you.
513-419-7100 is the number to call. If you'd like to join us, email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets. And Burl, this editorial came from you participating in a poverty simulator that's hosted by St. Vincent de Paul. And you note that in the simulator, you had an appointment to meet with a job placement counselor, but you'd have to be late to that because the walk was long. There was no money for bus fare because you needed a little bit of money for a security deposit on an apartment, no money for food. What did you learn from this experience?
Well, I think what I learned was it's very easy, if you've not experienced poverty, to be judgmental, to say, these people need to pick themselves up. There are plenty of programs, social programs to help. Why are they struggling? Why can't they figure it out? And the poverty simulator is designed to put you in that situation where you have a better understanding how, you know, we call it the hidden cost of being poor, where, for example, if you can't afford a washer and dryer and you have to go to a laundromat, over the course of a year, you're going to spend way more money on laundry than you did if you owned your own machine. So similar to that, the poverty simulator put us in a situation where we had a real life scenario and we had challenges. And in my particular situation, I looked at the mission. I had to, you know, secure my apartment. I had to talk to someone about a job. And I thought, well, this will be easy. And I go marching across the room and they said, stop, this is a 4-mile journey you're going to take. You need to take the bus or you need to walk. And if you are going to walk, you have to sit out for 10 minutes because that's about how long we're going to say the walk would take or come up with bus fare. And then right away you realize that, okay, the deck is stacked against you in a situation like this. And, you know, it was eye-opening for me, and I participated in it as part of Leadership Cincinnati this year, which is a program put on by the Chamber. And my fellow participants were so frustrated. Some were even, you know, fighting back tears because it's a humiliating experience to be in.
The Enquirer is devoting a full year on this issue, exploring it from different angles. What motivated the paper to take this exploration?
You know, I think that a lot of things came together. We were seeing our reporting on it in an incremental fashion. You know, census data came out, and we reported that that Cincinnati was lagging the state when it came to recovery after the recession, the improvement in the poverty rate. We had done stories on infant mortality rates. We had done stories about how Cincinnati public schools have 85% of their student population qualifying for meal assistance. And many of us felt that that incremental kind of reporting only goes so far, that we really needed to put a more clear picture together of what this all means. And that led to the centerpiece of our year-long effort is called The Long, Hard Road, where we actually sent reporters out. If you stand on Vine Street and look north, even though you're switching roads a little bit, you can basically take one route all the way up to Middletown, and same looking south, you can leave downtown and go all the way down to Falmouth and, you know, get out of our newsroom, get off of our desk chairs, and go out and tell the stories of people who are struggling financially.
What do you think that all of us in the journalism profession here locally need to do to better understand the economics and the conditions of people living in poverty?
Well, I think it's a back-to-basic approach. I think collectively we become too reliant on studies and the experts and email and texts and all the technology that makes our jobs easier. Nothing replaces going out and talking to people and experiencing in real time what they're going through. And I think, you know, the goal of this, we had a forum this week where we invited the community to learn more about the project. And in the Q&A, the participants or the people that came to the forum from the public were so their questions surrounded what can we do? What is the solution? And we're not really there yet with this report. I think it's too naive to say that what we're doing is going to finally solve the poverty dilemma. But what it can do is make us as a community more aware and sympathetic and empathetic to what people are going through, so that we might be able to tackle the problem one person at a time, one relationship at a time, one situation at a time, a little better if we take the time to not just report the statistics, but tell the stories of real people.
And Mark, that's what you had done over the past year or so, covering one particular family. You published a story recently that documents about 9 months of their lives. This was a family within the Cincinnati School District, so there are kids involved as well. Tell us about this family.
Well, Albert and I worked on this together since last August, and he did magnificent visuals, both video and stills.
Yeah, I have some questions about your approach to that as well, Albert.
But what we really wanted to do, and I think Burl kind of set that table, is it's easier to talk to experts, and there's nothing wrong with getting the context from experts and the statistics. But we only had one statistic in that story, which was there's roughly 3,000 children in Cincinnati public schools who experience homelessness during the school year. And we found a family that was experiencing homelessness, and they were very accessible to us, very open, and we spent a great deal of time with the ups and downs through the family. And I think it's a very simple journalistic concept: tell the truth and hold up the mirror, and this is who the people are. And I think one of the nice things that's happening out of all of our work this year on poverty is we are spending the time with real people. And, you know, we're limiting the experts per se and the studies and all of that stuff, and really just learning who people are, what their challenges are. You know, these aren't simulators. These are real life. You know, this woman had a blown tire on her van to an extent that every time that she, with her brakes going bad, every time she pulls out of her driveway with her 2004 Honda Odyssey, she's rolling the dice that something could go wrong with her kids in the van. So it was very real, from the food they ate to the medical issues they faced as a family. And we were just able through the, you know, her grace, graciousness to really get that up front and really in an unadorned fashion.
And Albert, you had a lot of really gripping imagery that was part of this documentation. And from a visual standpoint, as a visual storyteller, what were you looking to capture in the process here?
I think for a visual storyteller, when any time, firstly, it's very humbling for someone to let you, because I think to tell their story, to tell these children's story, I had to access parts of their lives that are private, that are considered private, that happened in their home or at the extended stay when they were homeless. And so what I was trying to accomplish was to show them in their struggle, but also in their humanity, so that other people, when they see the images, they can connect to the mother, you know, to get that kind of moment where the mother is embracing her child at the extended stay, or so that they could see you can see the love.
You had one image that I found particularly gripping. I mean, all of them were really either jarring or just numbing and very, very compelling. One had the caption, "Jasmine Austin embraces her mother, April Austin. On March 23, 2019, Jasmine broke into tears when she was told that her big sister had to stay another night in the hospital following a 12-hour breast reduction operation at the Cleveland Clinic." So you have the image of the sister in the hospital bed, and then you have this embrace with tears. I'm curious, you said humbling, but I wonder what it felt like for you personally to be there in the presence of that moment, which seems so private.
I think it's difficult, but, you know, you have to really, I guess for me, I really believed that she wanted me to tell her story as it is, and she wanted people to know this is really how my life is. And with kind of that trust and permission given to me, it is difficult. I actually had probably the hardest time with the picture of her in the van while she was crying, because it's just me and her, and it's dark outside, and she's in her van, and she's breaking down. And what I want to do is reach out and hug her, you know, and pay for the tire that went flat, which, you know, while we're telling the story, you just have to let it happen. And I think, again, it goes back to, it's humbling because, yes, it is, those are intimate and those are private. And it was her, I think, allowing us to kind of show her life, that kind of gives this story about these other people too, these 3,000 other kids, say this, she's kind of now allowed people to look at her life to say, this is common. This is a problem that exists in other people's lives too. And so that's, I guess, you know, those are hard, but I think that, you know, you try to be as respectful, and then you have to have that understanding. And I felt like we did, where it was like, you know, show my life as it is, don't sugarcoat it.
And Mark, Albert has described several of the images that include these very depressing moments in these people's lives and how hard it was to watch that. I'm wondering if you found during your 9 months long journey with these folks, whether you sense that they have any sense of hope at all.
I think so. I mean, she's a, as we accurately reported, she's a very faith-based woman. And she prays frequently, and we went to a religious service with her. She told us about her prayers for her children. We at the bedside that you just described, that beautiful photo that Albert got, you know, almost as if she became so comfortable with us there that, I mean, she prayed with her daughter who had the surgery as if it was just the two of them. And And I do think that April's, the mother, April Austin, her sense, a very wise woman, that I do think she sensed she was doing a larger good by opening her life to the media, that maybe, you know, it could educate, maybe it could, she was willing to do that. I think not just that she thought it was important, but there were moments that were very difficult where, you know, as people of middle-class means and professional means, you want to help, but you can't. And, but again, you come away understanding the great strength, resilience, that just getting day to day requires for these families that are experiencing this type of, you know, homelessness and poverty. And the children, we were amazed, I think, at how remarkably well-behaved her children were, how polite they were with us, and how comfortable they grew with us being around so much. And but again, there was where you may look in and judge from the outside and see chaos and something that is foreign to you, when you're allowed, as we were, to be within this family as much as we were, you see the order, you see the discipline, you see an older sister reading a book to the younger sister at night. You see all the things that are happening within this family that are loving, that are positive, that are nurturing. And the kids' behavior, you know, you have the little girl getting straight A's. You have a young man, 12 years old, who is being nominated for a science camp at NASA twice. You have a young girl overcoming her health challenges and graduating, you know, breaking a cycle within the family. It's quite remarkable.
Burl, what do we expect next out of the series?
So we're going to continue with the road through the end of the year. The next piece of it is going to get into the heart of the city and some more generational poverty, which I think is the most common thing people think about when we talk about poverty, which is why I think particularly the first installment that was up in the northern suburbs was eye-opening to a lot of people. You know, people who you think if you have a home in the suburb, you've got it made, you don't have to worry about things, but because of the slow recovery in some of in areas of our community, people who are not working at the same salary levels they were, but they have the same bills, they're one, you know, broken down car away from missing a mortgage payment and really struggling that way. So I think what people can expect is more of that journalism that we don't see a lot of anymore, unfortunately. I think that the commitment we're making to do this type of reporting where, you know, face it, we're in a real time, I need the information now, I'm going to move on to the next thing kind of, you know, world right now. And so to commit to a year-long project where we're investing time and reporters and photographers are spending hours and days before anything hits the public is what you can expect for the rest of the series. And I hope people appreciate that.
And we'll look forward to that. I want to thank our friends from the Cincinnati Inquirer, Burl Love, Mark Carnut, and Albert Caesar for coming in and talking to us about this today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, Democrat Amy McGrath raised a record $2.5 million in the 24 hours after she announced the challenge to Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. But then some comments upset progressive voters. We talk about it next. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. You come for the king, you best not miss. Democrat Amy McGrath launched her bid for the U.S. Senate in Kentucky, raised more than $2 million in a day, and then found herself backtracking comments she made about President Trump and Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh after catching grief from progressive voters and pundits. Now McConnell is selling McGrath flip-flops and already had a campaign website against her ready to go the minute she announced. So where does it all stand now? Joining Cincinnati Edition for the Friday News Review to talk about it, our Lexington Herald Leader reporter Daniel DeRochers. Welcome back, Daniel.
Hey, thanks for having me, Michael.
And Insider Louisville reporter Joe Sonka. Welcome back, Joe.
Thanks for having me again.
Questions, comments, 513-419-7100. So I don't know that I've ever seen a campaign rollout go so well and so poorly all at the same time. So there was this big announcement on a national morning show and a record amount of money raised in the first day. And then this pivot to walking back several comments after upsetting progressive voters and pundits. So let's start with what went right. Daniel, tell us who Amy McGrath is and why she says she's running.
Yeah, so Amy McGrath is a Marine Corps pilot. She was actually the first woman Marine to fly into combat in an F-18. And so she kind of launched on the political theme in 2018 when she wanted to challenge U.S. Representative Andy Barr here in Lexington in the 6th Congressional District. And she announced with this viral campaign video that kind of caught the attention of the country. And she was able to raise all of this money nationally, and that enabled her to kind of, you know, she ran this underdog campaign against Lexington Mayor Jim Gray, who was the favorite in that race, and she was able to upset him. But by the time she got to the general election, she hit Andy Barr, and Andy Barr kind of painted her as this person who was too liberal for Kentucky. And even though she definitely outperformed Hillary Clinton in the district, she fell 3 points short, and so she lost that 2018 congressional race. And so now she's back, and she's running for Senate, and we kind of saw a rollout similar to how she did it last time, where she went immediately to that kind of same national audience, that same national base that had given her a lot of money the first time around. And she just kind of spent the day only doing national shows. She didn't talk to, you know, the Herald Leader or the Courier Journal or Joe until the next day. And so she kind of bounced around on TV. And in that first interview on MSNBC's Morning Joe, right after she had done her whole campaign launch video where she told her story again and she talked about the importance of defeating Mitch McConnell, she said something that kind of attracted the attention of some of the more progressive Democratic voters in the state, where she said that Mitch McConnell was standing in the way of Donald Trump's policies. And so some people took that as, you know, yeah, look, Mitch McConnell is blocking, you know, these people voted for Donald Trump because they wanted to drain the swamp. And you know, Mitch McConnell's stopping him from doing some of the stuff that would be beneficial to Kentucky. But others took that as her kind of portraying herself as a pro-Trump Democrat who would be better for Donald Trump than Mitch McConnell. And that's kind of a hard hard argument to sell when Mitch McConnell is, of course, you know, one of the most powerful people in Republican politics.
And Joe, that was just one thing that kind of went wrong for her at first. What else went wrong in the aftermath? There were some comments about Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh and maybe some other issues.
Right. Well, I asked her if she would have voted for Brett Kavanaugh. And the answer she gave me originally was that while she disagreed with him on some things, there was nothing, there was absolutely nothing to disqualify him from being a Supreme Court justice, which I took as a yes. And in an interview with the Courier Journal also that day, she said she would probably vote yes on Kavanaugh. That received a lot of backlash on social media. And within a few hours, she sent out a tweet saying, actually, on second thought and reflection, I would have voted no. So I don't know if that was just a reexamination of his record or if she was hearing from some of her $3 million worth of donors who were saying, hey, wait a second, I gave you this money and I don't like what I'm hearing now.
And Joe, it looks like... Go ahead, Daniel.
I was just going to add, and that was a wild kind of change of position because she was on the record during her 2018 congressional race, right? She was running for Congress in 2018 when Kavanaugh was in the news. And she was on the record in July before even the accusations of sexual misconduct came out, calling Kavanaugh a partisan and saying that, you know, he was anti-woman and anti-reproductive rights. And so, you know, for her to kind of come flip-flop and then say, oh, after more thought, like when I asked her campaign about, you know, how did this evolve three times in a way, right? They said, well, she hadn't really made a decision about him the first time around. And that just seems kind of like a bizarre answer when you're on the record on Facebook and being hit by Republicans because you called him too partisan for the bench the first time around.
And so that's what I'm wondering here is what did Amy McGrath feel like she learned from 2018 that she's trying to incorporate here in this bigger, more important race that is now statewide, where she is altering this message a little bit?
Well, when she ran in 2018, she sounded quite a bit different than she sounded the first 2 days of her campaign, especially that kind of pro-Trump message in that she wants to help, you know, pass some of Trump's agenda. That really wasn't the focus of her 2018 race, and she certainly said things that were critical of Trump. So, you know, McGrath lost by 3% in a district that went to Trump by 15%, around 15%. Now she's running statewide where Trump won by 30%. So you have to wonder if there's a calculation here that she has to cozy up to Trump. And some have started to say this is hurting her authenticity, that if you want to run against Mitch McConnell, you have to be authentic. And if you change the way that you're presenting yourself from just a year ago, then some people are questioning you.
And now I'm seeing that Kentucky sports radio personality Matt Jones is possibly being encouraged to get into the race. This is something that he's flirted with for a couple of years now. Daniel, what did Matt Jones have to say about it?
Yeah, so yesterday, Matt Jones, he spoke to the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce, and he really just, he hit McGrath pretty hard. And I mean, he's kind of saying what all the Kentucky Democrats are thinking, but some are been a little reluctant to say. Basically what Joe said, right? Like that her authenticity is in question because of the way that this rollout has gone. And basically he called her over-consulted. He said that she's been consulted too much. You know, I think that that number that she raised, it's not, it's 3.5 million now. So she raised 3.5 million in those first 2 days. And that's, I think, a lot of money and can scare away any Democratic challenger, because you think, well, look, you got to spend a lot of money just to beat her in a primary. And then you got to go up against Mitch McConnell, who already has a huge war chest that he's been collecting since 2015. But there definitely are people who are still eyeing the race. I mean, there's Matt Jones, there's House Minority Leader Rocky Adkins, and even, you know, other names get tossed out, like Senate Minority Leader Morgan McGarvey. His name has been tossed out. And I just wanted to, I agree with Joe on how the messaging has definitely shifted from the first time around. You know, the way that she's talking about things, she's talking about draining the swamp. She's saying things like Mitch McConnell is blocking Donald Trump. And that was not her type of language the first time around. But her overarching message has actually been pretty similar. So her overarching message in her first campaign was country over party. I'm not going to be this partisan person. We need to end partisan politics in Kentucky. That was what she was trying to sell to people that first time around. The problem is that didn't work, right? Because she was on the record having all of these really liberal comments, right, saying that she was the most progressive person in Kentucky. And so when those ads were blasting over and over and over again with some of her more liberal statements, that wasn't jiving with the type of message she was trying to sell with her campaign. So it feels like she's trying to hit this reset button where she just consistently focuses on that more moderate appeal and tries not to give Mitch McConnell anything that would enable her to call her more liberal than anybody in Kentucky. But it almost feels like that ship has sailed, right? He's got the highlight reel from Andy Barr. It was only 2 years ago. It's really hard to kind of reset that message and rebrand and try to put your moderate bona fides when the you've already been painted as this really liberal candidate.
And to Daniel's point, Joe, it did not work for Amy McGrath in her 2018 congressional race in that district that includes Lexington and surrounding areas. And for any Democrat running statewide, they really have to run up the scoreboard in Louisville and Lexington. So what do we know about her chances based on her performance in that Lexington area congressional district last time around?
Well, she lost by 3%. It was close, and she did perform a lot better than Hillary Clinton in that district, yet she still lost. And that's the second most of the six congressional districts. That's the second most Democratic district. So if she wins, she would need to obviously run up huge margins in Louisville and Lexington, the two most Democratic cities. But then you get into the rural counties. And if you look at her performance in 2018, she performed really poorly in all those rural counties in her district outside of Lexington, Fayette County. So that's the big question mark is whether she can run up the score as much in Louisville and Lexington as possible and then kind of hold water enough in the rural areas to be competitive. And, you know, and of course, you know, the rollout in the first 2 days, I think McGrath really could have cleared the field if it went smoothly. But now you have a lot of people, you know, looking at the race now, some viable challengers. So she may have a competitive primary on her hands. So speaking about the general election maybe too soon.
You know, Mitch McConnell was elected to the Senate for the first time the year before I started kindergarten, and now I'm quite an old man myself. So, and Mitch McConnell has won all of these elections, but he has, you know, pretty high unfavorable rating. Daniel, how does he do it?
The Mitch McConnell machine, right? So, yeah, people might not like Mitch McConnell, but by the end of the race, Mitch McConnell makes sure that you like his opponent worse than you like him. Right?
That's exactly like right.
He just absolutely, you know, he's really, really good at that. He knows how to play the political game, and he has just this way of tearing down his opponents. And, you know, it's been 48 hours. I hadn't covered a Mitch McConnell campaign before, and just watching this is just, whew, it's a little bit of whiplash.
He had the website Wrong Path McGrath ready to go on any Google search, I mean, within moments of her announcement. And now they're selling these flip-flops, these Amy McGrath flip-flops. Mm-hmm. She flips, she flops, it says. So, I mean, he really doesn't mess around. He comes at you hard. But that's an election that is next year. We do have some elections in Kentucky this year. So before I let you go, I want to tell our audience about a little event called Fancy Farm, which is very well known across Kentucky. Joe, tell us what Fancy Farm is in case our friends here in Cincinnati don't quite know.
Fancy Farm is kind of like a mix between a campaign event or campaign debate and pro wrestling. people sweltering 100-degree heat in Western Kentucky, a very small town. They get under a little kind of a gazebo type covered area, and you have Democrats on the left and Republicans on the right, and they scream and heckle throughout your entire speech. It's kind of a throwback to a different age. Before I used to say it was like a throwback to a different age of politics in America, but in the Trump era, it seems kind of normal now in a way.
And Daniel, for the statewide candidates that are on the ballot this year for the constitutional offices like governor and attorney general, do we expect all the major candidates to show up this year?
Yeah, so the big question mark the past few years has been Governor Bevin, because he skipped it, I think, the last 2 years. And he is on board to go this year. He has been very adamant that he does not like the style that is Fancy Farm, because when you make your speech, you get heckled the entire time by the opposing political party. And so from what I understand, the last time he was up there, he gave a speech about how this is what's wrong with politics in America.
But it's just so strange because he doesn't have a lot of nice things to say about people.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of ironic. Yes, that's true. But he doesn't like that format. He thinks that, you know, it's not civil and that this isn't what politics should be about. You know, he likes to use, that slogan that's on the Kentucky flag, United we stand, divided we fall, even though he has definitely had some very divisive comments in the past.
And you'll both be there, I imagine.
Yep.
Probably not me.
I've avoided
the past 2 years because it's so terrible, but me, I don't know. Yeah.
All right. Joe Sonka from Insider Louisville and Daniel DeRochers from the Lexington Herald Leader. Thanks to both of you for joining us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks for having us.
The Hamilton County Commission supports more revenue for Cincinnati Metro buses, but not as much as the bus system would like. And joining us now to discuss that story is Inquirer transportation reporter Hannah Sparling. Welcome back, Hannah.
It's good to be here.
Appreciate you waiting to take us to the end of the show today. Tell us about what's going on here with this levy or how much revenue people are willing to negotiate
on. Sure. So things really look like, now I guess take this with a grain of salt because they've been kind of gearing up for levy for years and years now. But this year it really looks like they're going to go forward. It's kind of a broader coalition. And that's Metro, a couple different politicians, some countywide people, even some state reps are on board with it. The commissioners did come out this week and say, hey, we're all for more money, but just not quite as much as you guys want. The plan right now is 0.9 or 1% sales tax. The commissioners said up to 0.7 they would support.
And this would be something on a ballot for the voters?
Yeah, probably March of 2020, potentially November 2020.
What does Metro say, or this alliance of groups say, mm-hmm. that they need the money for?
Well, basically for everything. I mean, Metro's funding hasn't grown since, I believe, 1972. Which is just an incredibly long time to go. So, you know, buses are old, the routes are limited, the timing's limited. And so they're basically saying, hey, you guys have to decide. If you think public transit is important for our community, we need to fund it.
Okay, and so what role does the Hamilton County Commission play in this?
Well, if it's going to be a countywide levy, you know, you want countywide support. And the board, Metro's board, it's 13 members. Right now it's 7 from the city and 6 from the county. So a lot of those county appointees, the commissioners might have some sway with them. So you definitely wouldn't want them opposing it if you were trying to pass a levy.
Okay, so the consortium is asking for 1%.
1% or 0.9, that's kind of unclear.
Okay, so what's the difference in the amount of revenue that would be possible?
It's going to be, you know, tens of millions of dollars. And I think that the catch here is that the way they're trying to sell this levy is they're setting aside a portion just for general road repairs, roads and bridges. And if you back that down to 0.7, I just don't know that there'd be enough to really do that.
Okay, so if they're not able to get the full amount, mm-hmm. what have the pro-bus people said they won't be able to do?
I think it would probably have to be that roads portion, which they're saying is what makes this levy sellable. Because here, the vast majority of people here do not ride the bus. So it's something for those people to say, hey, you get something out of this too.
And if this is something that's going to be added as a form of a sales tax, this mm-hmm. is something that's sort of paid for by voters during purchases, what makes the commissioners think there's not an appetite for that at the full level that they're that the bus people are asking for?
I think they're just worried. It's not that there's not an appetite for 1%, but it's if there is an appetite for that, what else can't you do in the future? So I think there's just maybe some other things they would like to have some room for to raise the sales tax
so
for.
So there may be additional sales hikes in the future, yeah. but they want to make sure they don't hike it all in one place.
Yeah, nobody likes to get taxed then taxed again.
You also had a great story this week with the headline, Ohio roads are covered in trash. That's always fun to talk about. What did you mean?
Just that. They're covered in garbage. So the Ohio Department of Transportation keeps just a stunning spreadsheet of all the trash they pick up. And I was just fascinated by it. So I went out with one of their crews and just watched them pick up trash from the sides of the road. And it's just incredible. There's so much there.
What are they doing to curb that at all? I mean, obviously, good, decent people know not to throw their garbage out of the window.
Hope.
Let me read just part of what you wrote. Sure. It's the second paragraph in your story. Ohio roads are covered in trash. It's a huge waste of money and time. It's soggy cigarette cartons. I mean, we're not talking about cigarette butts, which are probably the most typical thing you find on the
ground. I'm sure those
were
there, too. The
cartons, of course,
are just
but cigarette
visible.
Cartons, empty Windex bottles, fast food wrappers, chunks of styrofoam, used straws, dirty diapers.
It's pretty nasty.
Yeah. So where's the campaign, or is there any way to affect change here in curbing this behavior from motorists?
Well, I think one thing is through ODOT was very helpful with this story. I think they like to get the word out about how trashy everything is. They have their Adopt a Highway program where you can volunteer to clean up a stretch or pay for someone else to clean it up. But other than that, they're just kind of doing it. And it's something volunteers, inmates, and state employees do.
And the second part of that headline was that it's a big waste of money and
time.
Yeah,
it's about $4 million a year that they spend just picking up trash.
And that's all money spent on the workers? Or is that the 3.9 million bags of trash is another
subheadline? Yeah, so it'd be workers. If it's inmates that are collecting, it'd be paying the guards that need to oversee them. So it's a couple different things, but that's just the amount they've calculated that it's costing really us because we're the ones who pay for ODOT.
And here's a quote from a gentleman from ODOT who says these guys could be out fixing guardrails or potholes, but we have to deploy folks around the state to pick up other people's junk. I mean, how often are these folks on patrol? Is this a daily task?
It's not daily. They said it's sort of kind of comes and goes. So it just depends on what's on their schedule otherwise that week. But one of the workers I talked to, he got pretty kind of sad when he was talking about it because he doesn't feel good when he's picking up trash. You know, it's something that needs to be done, but he knows he's going to pick it up and then someone's going to throw something else out the window.
I know sometimes in journalism we think, gosh, it can't get any worse than this. And then you take a ride on that truck
turns out.
And find out it can. Hannah Sparling from the Cincinnati Inquirer, really appreciate you coming in.
Oh, thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstrow. You can find links to today's stories and archives of all of our previous shows at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.